And you hate it.
We'll call the meeting to order, the hour of 10:15 having arrived. We have our agenda today. We're going to hear from a gentleman to give some testimony in support of the governor's budget proposal. Then we will go directly into the House File 451, and I'll explain that, and the DE1 amendment. And then we will, let's see, we didn't have any amendments as of the 24-hour rule. Oh, we don't have a 24-hour rule. So we will entertain amendments then at that point, and then we'll be voting on the bill by noon. But I would like to, if we could, we have a gentleman here, an economist. My friends on the other side of the aisle requested that we hear from some economists. So we have one, an economist will make a presentation, and then we've offered, of course, some of you should have got the email, or was that just to Ripson Lincheski? Ripson Lincheski, you got the email that we'd like someone that might have some different views as far as the economist goes. And then, and so we will, that will not be today, but it will be as soon as we can get whoever you want scheduled in. So with that, if the gentleman could join us to provide testimony on behalf of the governor's budget, a Mr. White, I believe. Mr. James White. You have 2 to 3 minutes, sir, and then we'd open up for questions to make your thoughts known on the governor's budget proposal. Please state your name, and we do not have a quorum yet. As soon as we do, we'll break in and officially call the meeting to order. If you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Okay, my name is James White. I'm from St. Paul. I'm a private citizen, and I do not represent any group.
Mr. White, welcome to the committee. We do have a quorum. We'll officially call the meeting to order of the House Tax Committee on February 24th, 2011. Please proceed, sir.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak here. I am here mainly because I am seeing, and I'm sensing a sense of a, by the way, I'm in support of Governor Dayton's budget proposal, but I sense there is this erosion of what they call the common good. And I'd like to say the common good is sort of this glue that holds us together as a society, this sense that we're kind of in this game together. We do provide for each other. And sort of the nuts and bolts of this are things like, you know, schools, parks, libraries, roads, transit, our judicial system, whatever. Obviously, they all cost money. We provide for them through taxes. Yet we have heard so much, taxes are bad. We got to cut. Government's the problem. But I might suggest that we maybe look at things just a maybe slightly differently. In the interest of brevity here, I'm going to just offer a couple little ideas that I have that I think could raise some revenues without too much pain on the part of the citizens of this state. I'm a mortgage banker, and there's a little known tax that nobody really talks too much about. It's called the MRT, Mortgage Revenue Tax. I've been a loan officer for many years, and I've been collecting this tax with every loan that I've closed. It's figured at 2.23 per thousand, or 23 basis points, for every county except Hennepin and Ramsey, where it is 0.24 per thousand. And interestingly enough, I've never had a client say, well, I'm not going to pay that. I don't want to pay that. I'm not going to buy that house because of the MRT. People say, okay. In fact, I sort of kid them and say, and if you don't like it, well, call your representative. But this is a tax we've had for many years. I might suggest looking at increasing this to, let's say, 50 basis points. This would allow or offer the state sort of a steady source of income for years and years into the future. Another thing is our state income tax rates. I've done a little studying on that. 5.30 to the lowest, 7.85 to the highest right now. And by the way, I do not like that tax the rich. Tax all of us according to our ability to pay. I might suggest increasing that taxing, the tax on the lowest rate to, let's say, 50 basis points to 5.80, and on the highest from 7.85 to 9.15. I think this will do a lot to cut, to close this really terrible deficit that we are looking at here. And I'm really, and the message really to you, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, is please work together. Come to a viable solution and solve this budget crisis for once and for all. We do need to raise taxes in a prudent and sensible way. And by all means, my greatest fear is a government shutdown, both on the federal and the state level. And basically asking if you could remember this idea of the common good. Also remember that when you do cut, when you make cuts, you're cutting jobs. Jobs that this state so desperately needs. So I basically am asking you to work together, get this thing done. look at tax increases. It's not going to kill us. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you, Mr. White. Any questions for Mr. White? Okay, thank you very much. Representative Mack moves the minutes from February 23rd. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I will move House File 451 be recommended, passed, and sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. I will move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I'd prefer. Any questions on the DE1 amendment? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. We don't have the bill? Oh. Well, thanks, members, for supporting a bill that you don't have. If you could, for just a second, I would like a page to pass out a letter that basically, folks, the DE1 amendment is the bill, so you should have that. So I'll start describing the bill a little bit. I'd also like to have a page pass out letters to members about 9:30 or so. I looked in my mailbox, and there was a letter from the governor that I'm going to share with you, and the letter is asking the Tax Committee in the House and the Senate. I guess this one talks about the House. You'll be getting this letter. If you could just take a second to read, it's very short. Governor Dayton has asked that we basically pass House File 451, plus he's looking at three other provisions. It would be the deduction for K-12 educator classroom expenses, the deduction for tuition and related expenses, the enhanced charitable contribution to business for their donated computers. And that is, those have not been conformed with since, I believe, 2006. Is that correct, Mr. Michael, or Ms. Manzi? That's correct. Okay, so this is the basis. The DE1 amendment is what we're working off of. And if you could just take a moment to read the letter from our good governor in support of the Davids bill. To some point here, it's not exactly the same as what the governor's asking for, but we're getting awful close there. So, with that, you should have a House research overview for House File 451, the DE1 amendment. So, at this point, I would open it up for discussion, or we could get amendments going. Representative Lincheski, would you like to get some amendments going here?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have that letter, the same letter too, to pass out. So. I think we all got those delivered today. And, Mr. Chair, if I could just ask you, we have an amendment prepared to ensure the bill looks exactly how Governor Dayton would like it. And can you tell me if your DE1 amendment does this line up with what you hear the governor saying on the letter?
Representative Lemcheski, not quite, and I just explained that what we did not have in the DE1 amendment would be the 2006 items that have been conformed since 2006, which would be the deduction for K-12 educator classroom expenses, two, the deduction for tuition-related expenses, three, the enhanced charitable deduction business for their donated computers. Now, Ms. Manzi, would it be safe to say if those were on the DE1 amendment that would conform with what the governor's letter refers to?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, if those three items were added, it would match the wording of the letter from the governor, who lists those three items at the bottom of the first page.
Okay. Okay. So at this point, we can either have discussion or we could take amendments, and I hope there's support on both sides of the aisle. This is Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you explain what's in the DE1 amendment?
Oh, certainly.
Is somebody going to go through it?
No, I'll have is it Nina Manzi or should it be, is this Nina? Ms. Manzi, if you could just describe. Members, you have in the House, in your package, you should have the House research summary, the overview of what's in it, and then where it says it would not conform to the following things. Now, that doesn't match up exactly with what the governor is requesting. But Ms. Manzi, if you could describe the base DE1 amendment as it stands right now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the DE1 amendment would conform Minnesota's income tax for tax year 2010 only to most of the provisions of the four federal laws that have been enacted since last March, the two health care reform laws, the Small Business Jobs Act, and then the December tax relief bill. The principal changes that Minnesota would conform to are listed on the first page of the summary in the overview. There's more detail on all of those items on the second, third, fourth, and fifth pages of the summary. Mr. Chair, would you like me to go through all the provisions or just talk about the major ones?
Excuse me?
Mr. Chair, would you like me to go through all of the provisions that Minnesota would conform to or just talk about the principal changes? I can go through them all, but they're listed on several pages.
Ms. Manns, before the record, why don't we go through all of them?
Sure. Okay, Mr. Chair, starting with the health care reform bill, the two health care reform bills, the bill would conform to the income exclusion of health insurance benefits for adult children up to and including age 26. Under prior federal law, this exclusion was limited to dependents who are under age 19, students under age 24, or dependents who are permanently and totally disabled. Would conform to the increase in the maximum exclusion for employer-provided adoption assistance for tax year 2010. It would conform to allowing an income exclusion for state loan forgiveness programs for healthcare professionals that's intended to increase the availability of those health professionals in underserved areas. That provision in the federal law was retroactive to tax year 2009, and the bill would conform for tax year 2010 only. It would conform to the federal codification of the economic substance doctrine in the healthcare reform bill. Then the Small Business Jobs Act provision, one of the first provisions in that bill that people pay attention to is the Section 179 expensing allowance increase. Under the DE-1 amendment, Minnesota would not conform to increase Section 179 expensing, but would continue its practice of requiring taxpayers to add to taxable income 80% of the difference between the old expensing amount and the new expensing amount, and then subtract one-fifth of the amount added in each of the next five following tax years. The bill would take the same treatment with regard to the extension of 50% bonus depreciation that occurred in the Small Business Jobs Act. It would conform to the federal treatment of the a percentage completion method for long-term contracts. This is sort of a corresponding issue to the bonus depreciation. When bonus depreciation is allowed, then people using the percentage completion method for long-term contracts would have to recognize more of their income in the front years of the early years of the contract rather than in the later years of the contract. And this provision makes it so that they can recognize the costs as they would have happened in the absence of bonus depreciation. Conforms to the increase in the amount of startup expenditures that can be directly expensed in the first year of a startup, increasing that from $5,000 to $10,000. Removes cell phones and similar devices from listed property so that the employer deduction for cell phone expenses is not reduced by any personal use of the phone by the employee. It allows participants in government Section 457B plans to make non-excludable contributions to associated Roth IRA accounts if their employer provides them. This puts them on the same treatment as participants in 401K and 403B plans. It also allows amounts that are rolled over from qualified distributions to associated Roth accounts in 2010 to be recognized 50% in tax year 11 and 50% in tax year 12 rather than all in tax year 10. And finally, it reduced the share of income on guarantees that could be sourced outside the United States. The tax relief bill from December, and when I'm going through these, I'm only listing the items from those bills that affect tax year 10. There may be other items in those bills that only affect later tax years, which I'm not referencing. So the tax relief bill from December extended what are commonly referred to as the Bush tax cuts. The extension of the Bush tax cuts is effective for tax years 11 and 12. So this bill, as amended by the DE-1 amendment, does not address the issue of the Bush tax cut extension since it's only addressing tax year 10. One of the first things that the tax relief bill did was it increased the bonus depreciation for the remaining months of tax year 10, and it extended that increased depreciation to tax year 12, or tax year 11, rather. Minnesota would continue to not conform to this under the bill, but retain its 80% add back, and then you subtract one-fifth of that over the next 5 years. The same thing is true with regard to Section 179 expensing. Oh, no, I guess the Section 179 expensing in the tax relief bill was for tax year 12, so I'm not going to talk about that. Then it extended the teacher classroom expense deduction to tax years 10 and 11. The DE1 amendment does not conform to this provision, but continues Minnesota's treatment of requiring taxpayers to add that amount to taxable income. It extended the option for taxpayers to claim an itemized deduction for sales taxes paid rather than income taxes paid. This one does not affect Minnesota taxpayers, since current law requires any income or sales taxes deducted at the federal level to be added back, so it doesn't really matter to our tax if they extend the deduction for the sales tax. It extended an increase in the federal income limit on the amount of conservation easements that can be claimed as charitable deductions. It extended the higher education tuition expense deduction. This is another one where the DE1 amendment does not conform to the federal change, but instead continues the treatment of requiring taxpayers to add this amount back to taxable income. It extended the authority for individuals 70 and a half years of age or older to transfer up to $100,000 from an IRA directly to a charity and to exclude that amount from adjusted gross income. It also allowed that distributions made after December 31st of last year and February 1st of this year could be recognized in tax year 10. It extended a whole range of provisions related to depreciation and expensing, including more generous rules for leasehold and restaurant improvements, motorsports entertainment complexes, mine safety equipment, accelerated depreciation for business property on Indian reservations, qualified film and television production expenses. It extended the enhanced deduction for contributions of food inventory, book inventory, and computers. These are charitable contributions by businesses. Minnesota would not conform to this deduction with regard to the computers. It would conform with regard to the contributions of food inventory and book inventory. Taxpayers who donated computers would be required to add the amount back to taxable income. This is the same treatment for these sorts of donations at the state level from tax years 2007 to 2009. It extended preferential treatment of dividends on regulated investment companies for 2 more years, and extended for 2 more years the limit on basis adjustments in S-corporation stock when S-corps donate appreciated property to be the tax basis of the property rather than the fair market value. These last two provisions were extended for 2 years, but this bill only addresses them for tax year 2010, like everything else. The next two sections of the bill are date updates in the section of Chapter 290 that defines federal adjusted gross income used in computing the alternative minimum tax and determining withholding, and also that is the starting point for our refundable credits. And the next one updates the date reference to the Internal Revenue Code in the property tax refund chapter. And the final section of the bill is a little uncodified section that provides that employers who issued W-2s already to their employees, which they all should have done since it's now February, listing the value of the health insurance that the employer provided to the adult children of the employees up to age 26. They're not going to be required to issue corrected W-2s to the employees. Instead, what would happen if this bill were enacted is that the Department of Revenue would put instructions on its website and distribute those instructions to tax preparers, telling affected taxpayers that they no longer would have to add to taxable income the amount listed on the W-2 as the value of the health insurance coverage for their older adult children. And I think those are the main provisions.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 3 of the summary, at the very bottom, you talked about a provision that allows a temporary 100% bonus depreciation for property placed in service between a few dates. And I'm wondering if you could give an example of what kind of property this is dealing with, and if you can walk through the Minnesota treatment of this, so I can just kind of get a concept of how we're treating it differently than the federal.
Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, this would be property generally used in a business, some sort of a piece of equipment, for example. So, say you operate a manufacturing firm and you have a device that you use in the plant to make the widgets that you make, and let's just say for the case of the example that device costs you $100,000. Is that will be easy for me to do the math if it costs that. So at the federal level, under prior federal law, before there was bonus depreciation, what you would have to do is take that $100,000 and then claim it over the life of the piece of property, whatever its class life was. It could be a 5-year or a 7-year class life. Under bonus depreciation, and this provision in this particular bill is the highest percentage bonus depreciation that we've seen. So under this law, if you bought that thing after September 8th, 2010, and if you placed it in service in your plant then, and before January 1st of 2012, you would get to claim as a deduction on your business return from your income the whole $100,000 right when you put it in service, instead of taking it over the life of the machine. What the state would provide is that, okay, let's say it was a 10-year machine. So I'm going to leave aside the accelerated depreciation factors and everything, and we'll just pretend that it's a 10-year machine and it's on a straight line basis. And you would ordinarily get to take $10,000 of it per year for 10 years. So at the state level, you would have been required to track it for 10 years and take $10,000 in each year. At the federal level, you're taking the $100,000. What you do in the first year is you take the difference between the $10,000 and the $100,000, or $90,000, and you would have to add back to your state taxable income 80% of that. So that $90,000 is sort of the bonus amount. So 80% of $90,000 is going to be $72,000. So you're going to add back $72,000 at the state level in the first year, and then over the next 5 years, you're going to take that $72,000 and divide it by 5, and that is going to be 14.4 or something like that, close to that. So then in each of the next 5 years, you're going to subtract 14,400 from your taxable income. So that 14,400 times 5 plus the 72 should be, or no, I'm sorry, plus the 18 that you actually got in that first year, because you added back 72,000 of the 90. So at the end of the 6 years, you've taken at the state level the same $100,000 that you took at the federal level. We did it that way. Minnesota started treating bonus depreciation that way in 2002, there was a federal law enacted that provided for 50% bonus depreciation, and it had a rather large price tag to conform with, and we were also experiencing budget shortfalls at the time. And I recall being at a meeting at the Department of Revenue with members of the business community, legislative staff, department staff, and people said, we don't have the money to do this. How can we make it easier for businesses to comply with it? And the businesses, the business representatives said, well, it's not going to be very easy for us to track the depreciation on these things differently for the state than we are at the federal. Because at that time, it wasn't 100% where it's just over with at the federal. It was 50%, and then you take the rest of it on the normal basis over whatever the life of the thing is. So someone came up with this approach of saying, take the difference between the two, add 80% of it back in the first year, and then just take whatever it was you added back, so that's one number that's on your tax return for this year, and then divide it by 5 in each of the next 5 years and subtract it. And, you know, everyone agreed that that was simpler than just not conforming. And a lot of other states just didn't conform on this because it was a revenue issue for a lot of states. And we've that round of bonus depreciation was extended once, and then bonus depreciation went away for a while, and now it's come back in the last 2 or 3 years, and we've resumed this treatment of it.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That's really helpful for me. Sorry, I'm new to the committee. And then I have a second question. On page 5, you mentioned an item of extending preferential treatment of dividends of regulated investment companies. Do you know what that means? Is it
Ms. Manzi?
Changing them from the income category to the capital gains category?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, I have a piece of paper in this folder that says something about that, and if you give me a moment, I will find that. Okay. And I think Mr. Michael is doing the same thing, looking for the same thing.
While we're looking for the answer to Representative Hartman's question, I'm going to bring Mr. Mossman to the table, who wants to make a clarification on something that was said. In fact, why don't you do that right now? If you state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Matt Mossman, Assistant Commissioner for Tax Policy with the Department of Revenue. Just one minor adjustment to Ms. Manzi's description. The governor's budget includes conformity, certainly, to all of these provisions. With the addition to the DE amendment of the three educator-related provisions that have been discussed. The governor's budget does not include, would not include conformity to the exception under subpart F for active financing income. And so I just want to make sure for the record that that's clear in terms of what is in the governor's budget documents that were submitted to you.
Thank you, Mr. Mossman. And if you just stay there, might have some more questions. Yeah, I want to be very clear on how this compares to what the governor is proposing here. Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, with regard to the letter that you all received from the governor, the subpart F income item is not listed in that letter. With regard to the governor's budget, the governor's budget proposes to continue not conforming to an exclusion from subpart F income that's allowed at the federal level.
I was going to mention that,
yep.
Mr. Mossman.
I think, yep, and Matt is nodding.
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair and committee, that's correct. The governor would propose to continue not conforming, so we would update the public law reference that would be needed in the language that we would bring forward to not conform to that. That would be the governor's position.
We're still with Representative Hartman's issue. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hartman, regulated investment companies, to turn tax speak to common speak, are mutual funds. And essentially mutual funds are like partnerships and S-corps and so forth, and that they're generally taxed on a pass-through basis. So the tax is actually paid by the shareholder, not by the investment company, the mutual fund itself. There are some quirks in that. What this relates to is that when you have foreign shareholders and there's dividends that are essentially the way the pass-through works is that the regulated investment company, the mutual fund, is allowed a deduction for the dividends that they pay to their shareholders. There is in federal law a special provision that says that if you've got a foreign shareholder that the deduction doesn't exactly apply the same way. And what this does, this is one of these extender provisions that's been extended several times, and what it says is that special exception for foreign shareholders doesn't apply for this, you know, in this case for the 1 year, and so the mutual fund would actually get this, they'll deduct those dividends that are paid, and so it would not be liable for tax on those dividends that are paid to the foreign shareholders.
Jeff Hartman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to understand what we're voting on. I could ask a question like that on every section, but I won't.
We've got till noon. Representative Lencheski.
Mr. Chair, I do have a couple questions, but while Mr. Mossman is still there, maybe if to finish that discussion on the subpart F provision, or maybe it's for you, Mr. Chair, what's the price tag on that provision that you are conforming and Governor Dayton is not recommending that? Or maybe Ms. Templin wants to walk through the spreadsheet on the whole bill, but I'm just trying to understand what the price tag of that one is.
Mr. Michael or Ms. Manzi, do you have a price tag on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lencheski, let's see, and Mr. Mossman can nod again if I'm right, but the language in the DE1 amendment would have a revenue reduction in tax year 10 of $1.5 million because it conforms to the subpart F income exclusion. The governor's budget is revenue neutral with regard to subpart F because it adds the updated public law reference in 290.01 subdivisions 19C and 19D.
Are you nodding, Mr. Moss?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Ms. Manzi and I are smiling because we had a late night conversation about this last night, and I did talk to our research staff.
Mr. Mossman, you have to get a life.
In talking with
Mr. Mossman,
you're just a little bit.
Just a little. It was over the phone. And
that doesn't change anything, Mr. Mossman. That's all they do it these days.
Back to subpart F, which is a much more mundane topic, I'm sure. As I understand it, in talking to our research staff this morning, the forecast, essentially, the current federal public law for subpart F exception expires. And so there's no assumption of an exception for subpart F for this provision in the current state forecast. And so if current law treatment of the subpart F exception were continued, as we have done in the past, which is what the governor recommends, i.e. not conforming to the federal change, there would be a loss of revenue relative to our forecast of what I think is $1.2 million. That's what's on the...
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I had the second year's number.
Yep. $1.2 for 2010 is the short answer from the department's perspective as to what would be the cost of conforming to the subpart F provision.
Thank you. Representative Lencheski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if Ms. Templin can go through, it's a pretty extensive spreadsheet to understand, you know, I mean, there's a lot of spending going on, if we can understand the whole bill.
Ms. Templin? And then it would be my intention when Ms. Templin's done, we will go to amendments, and then we do have another guest to visit with us today that I'd like to get to. Ms. Templin, to answer Representative Lencheski's question.
Mr. Chair, I'm Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. If I could just go through, I think the question is what is the revenue impact of the House File 451 DE1 amendment? Right. And starting with the revenue estimate, you see there's four federal acts And the first, the cost of the health care bills, there's two health care bills, is $350,000 in fiscal 11 with no cost after fiscal 11. The Small Business Jobs Act of 2010, the cost is in fiscal 11, just less than $2 million, $1.9 million. And in fiscal 12 and 13, the cost is there's a revenue gain of $17 million. Just looking. And with in fiscal 14 and 15, there is a revenue loss of around $20 million. And then moving to the tax relief federal bill, in conformity to that, the cost in fiscal 11 is $5,065,000 and a revenue gain of just over $1 million in fiscal 12 and 13, with a revenue loss of about $6 million in fiscal 14 and 15. These four federal bills combined, the revenue impact in fiscal 11 is $7.4 million, and in fiscal 12 and 13, there's a revenue gain of $18.5 million. And in fiscal 14 and 15, there is a revenue loss of $26.5 million for conforming to these four federal bills.
Any questions for Ms. Templin? Representative Lincheski, you still have the floor.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just trying to think through kind of how you designed the DE1 and kind of that bottom line on general fund total. You know, as members can see, there's a cost and a gain, then some cost. And I was noting on, you know, the individual price tags, it looks like most of the zero items are a one-time cost, and then they probably don't ever have a cost again going forward. And I just wanted to know if Ms. Templin could, is there anything that, you know, is major that we should take note of that may look as like a zero but will be cost, it'll have cost outside the window that we're not seeing on here? Does anything jump out?
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, if you could give me a minute, and I will get back to that. There may be one provision where we see that. Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, in the Small Jobs Business Act, there is a provision. It's the increase from 75% to 100%, the capital gains exclusion for small business stock. The revenue impact occurs after fiscal year 15. And I think that is the one provision where the revenue impact is delayed in this amended version of House File 451.
Representative Lincheski.
Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Michael can guess what that might cost in the next year. I'm just curious, and the reason I'm asking, Mr. Chair, is, you know, members get pretty crafty around here, and they draft bills that are zeros for 5 years, and then there's a big hidden cost later. And, you know, in conformity, I think it's legitimate to do that because there are, you know, costs, ongoing, permanent. But I'm just wondering if there's any surprise in there that as members actually go through the spreadsheet, they don't know.
Well, Representative Lincheski, I am pretty crafty. Mr. Michael, what did I do?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, I think the right way to think about this is that this is a tax year 10 bill only, so it does not conform on an item like that going forward. So if this were a permanent bill, yes, there is a cost out beyond the window on that, because that's when people start realizing those gains, since there's this five-year holding period. But that will be a decision that would have to be made in another bill that conforms for tax year 11 and going forward. So really, the chair is not being crafty here.
Darn, next time. Mr. Chair, though, and I'm trying
it
to...
better be. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you. I'm trying to be transparent here because I have an amendment in here to do permanent conformity on a lot of these items. So, you know, they are costs. Tax conformity costs money to pass on tax cuts to Minnesotans, and I just wanted to kind of see what I might not be aware of in there, so I appreciate the time on the spreadsheet for members.
Thank you, Representative Lincheski. Okay, with that, we will get into amendments. Representative Lincheski, if you have some amendments that could be passed out.
I do, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to ask Ms. Manzi if she can tell me if the governor's conformity is the DE2 or the DE3, and I'm not sure myself, so I'll give this to the pages.
Ms. Manzi?
But I don't know which one it is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski and members of the committee, the governor's conformity for tax year 10 is the DE2 amendment. That is the same as it has the same language as the DE1 amendment, except that it would conform on the higher education tuition subtraction, the educator expense deduction, the enhanced deduction for charitable contributions of computers, the three items in the governor's letter, and also it would not conform on the subpart F income, thereby avoiding the $1.2 million revenue loss.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendments are that we have, they were sitting over on that table over there. I don't know what happened to them, but, you know, I'm just in the, I know you're trying to get done, you know, maybe they want to pass them all out, but I didn't realize that they had not.
Well, we'll see how they go one by one, because okay. We do not need to offer them all.
Okay, so so this is the DE2, and I don't think anybody has it.
Could you please pass out the DE2 amendments so the committee can study that for a second here? Okay, members, just to announce that if we get bogged up in amendments, this bill is going to go out today at some point. So even though I said we weren't having a meeting tonight, we do still have the room, apparently. So I'll have to make a decision on that. We'll see how these go. Representative Lincheski, if you could please describe your amendment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the amendment is, as Ms. Manzi just described it, and again, it's basically the governor's letter to all of us. You know, I think what the governor is signaling to the legislature, he'd like to get conformity done, and we all know it's, you know, February 24th, and it should have been done a while ago, and we need to get it done. This is helping our taxpayers in Minnesota get the tax cuts that Congress has passed for them, and people are filing now, and so time is of the essence. I think Governor Dayton is signaling, as we heard the assistant commissioner describe, that he would like that we continue to afford Minnesotans tax benefits, particularly in the areas of education, the deduction for the K-12 educator classroom expenses added in this amendment, the deduction for the tuition and related expenses, and the enhanced charitable deduction to business for donated computers, minus the subpart F that is in the chair's DE1 amendment. So, again, if you just refer the simple way to think about it to Governor Dayton's letter, with this amendment, this would be Governor Dayton's position on federal conformity, and I would just encourage members to support the amendment.
Okay, thank you, Representative Lincheski. Do you have any numbers on the added cost, or is there added cost, or maybe Ms. Manzi could give us some numbers, or do you have them?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Templin does. You know, I'll be honest, we did not know we were voting on this bill.
Representative Lincheski, I've never questioned your honesty.
Well, we didn't know we were voting on this bill until like 9 o'clock last night. So we did have staff working with us, and I think Ms. Templin felt she had some pretty good numbers on all the various provisions, and maybe she can tell us what each of the three cost. And then, of course, you'd have to minus out the cost of subpart F. That would be a revenue gain. And how that would work on a revenue estimate in total.
Ms. Templin, to my question on the numbers.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. One way to look at this is with the DE2 amendment. If you work off revenue estimate for House File 451 and you add to fiscal year 11 the cost of the teacher deduction, which is $1 million, and the cost of the deduction for qualified tuition, which is $4.2 million, and the deduction for computers. I was just talking with Mr. Mossman, and the estimate for that is $500,000. So with the addition of those three, it is $5.7 million is the additional cost that would be in fiscal 11 if you add that to the cost in the House File 451 DE1 amendment. And then you add back the subpart F, the cost is the total cost for the tax relief bill is about $11 million. In fiscal 11, and there would be no changes to the revenue impact after fiscal 11.
Okay, Representative Lincheski moves the DE2 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Biskins? No. Oh, yeah, Representative Biskins?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think there's a way for all of us to be able to support Representative Lincheski's amendment and bring peace to the valley. Mr. Chair, I'd like to amend the Lincheski amendment.
Representative Biskins, if you state your amendment, please.
On page 6, line 18, reinstate the stricken language.
Okay.
All right. And delete the new language on 18 and 19. And then on, are we tracking, Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
On page 10, line 34, reinstate the stricken language. And on lines 34 and 35, delete the new language.
Okay, do members understand the amendment to the amendment? Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that if we could have Ms. Manzi and Mr. Michael clarify that. My understanding of what Representative Biskins is trying to do is add back in the subpart F to the amendment. Is that correct, just for clarity?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lincheski. What I'm trying to do is match the spirit and the letter of the letter from the governor.
What? Actually, I believe that in the letter, he prefers the language as it is before us in the amendment. No, he doesn't? Oh, that's correct. Okay. Okay, Representative Lincheski?
Well, Mr.
Chair. I'm sorry, Representative Biskins, you're correct. Sir.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think anyone, my experience in this committee is everybody supports conformity, so I'm honestly not trying to, you know, do anything here except get federal conformity passed into law for taxpayers. So the way I understand it is that the DE1, your bill, is quite a bit away to federal conformity in according to the governor's letter. He's looking for these additional three provisions and taking subpart F out, which is what my amendment was doing. Okay, so I understand Representative Biskin's amendment to my amendment to put subpart F back in and sort of cutting the baby in half, your DE1 plus three new provisions. If that's not accurate, I think we need to hear from Mr. Michael or Ms. Manzi exactly what the Biskin's amendment is doing.
Well, Representative Lynch,
I heard it was in the spirit, but I don't know that that's technically.
Yeah. Representative Biskins? Well,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, and yeah, I think my amendment is, and maybe Mr. Michaels can provide further clarification, but I do think it my amendment would then have the DE2 conform to the governor's letter.
Mr. Michaels, is that a correct statement?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the governor's letter makes no reference to the subpart F add back, and so it would be certainly consistent with the language of the letter.
Personal and Chesky.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. But technically on the bill, and you know, I heard that part, is when the reference was made on striking these lines and moving other things, is the subpart F being added back in the Biskin's amendment?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, with the Biskin's amendment, the state would be conforming to the federal treatment of subpart F income, whereas the practice in the past had been that the state had not conformed for several years on that. And this, it relates to banks' ability to defer foreign income.
Mr. Chair?
Which is current federal law, that they can do that. Representative Lincheski.
Mr. Chair, if I may, and I hear that and agree that the letter itself does not call out subpart F, could we ask Mr. Mossman to sort of weigh in on, you know, this decision? I think we're trying to, if I understand it, both sides here are trying to get, a good piece of federal conformity language done. Just kind of
And before Mr. Mossman starts, please, you'll need to state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir. But Representative Chesky, I'm speaking for myself here, but I would be very supportive of what's in the governor's letter for the three additional items. I'm not comfortable with, I'd like to conform with the federal government on F also. So that's where I'm coming from. Of course, that's why we have a lot of members here to vote. But Mr. Mossman, to the Lencheski question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lencheski and members, first and foremost, I think the governor feels strongly that tax year 2010 conformity needs to happen, and that it in a timely manner. And obviously, taxpayers are waiting to have some certainty in that regard. The budget, the letter itself, the intent, as I understand it from the letter, was really to call out his preference on the three provisions and ensure that those were in his. I don't know that he feels as strongly about the subpart F. I know he did not include it in his budget proposal. The issue being, as you know, all of the individual budget choices were being made, he didn't feel that $1.2 million and the $1.5 the next year fit into his budget, so it would be a departure from his budget in that regard. But I think that in terms of the letter, he feels most strongly about these three provisions being included in the bill in terms of conformity.
Representative Biskins, to your amendment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members and Commissioner. I think if he had felt strongly about that part being in the Davids bill, I would have think he'd put it in the letter. If he wants to move this through quickly, all right, and get this going, I appreciate that. But if he was serious about that, it'd be in this letter. Otherwise, as this bill keeps moving forward, if the governor keeps changing the target, we're not going to meet his desire to get this moving through the process quickly. So, and Mr. Chairman, I'm going to take the governor at his word and the commissioner that, and this is an opportunity for us to, as you so fondly use the phrase, find peace in the valley. I think, and I'm not used to this, but I think this is called compromise. All right.
You're not used to peace in the valley?
No, compromise.
Compromise.
Right. I think that this
and,
is
and
what
Mr.
it's
Mossman,
called.
And Mr. Mossman, if you look at the big picture here, I think we're making great strides here to do some good things. And as far as the F issue goes, we can certainly debate that for the next several months for 11 and 12 and beyond. But I'd certainly like to conform with that at this point. But we'll see how the members feel. And I'd like to move this along, but I do want the discussion. Representative Lencheski, then Hartman. Representative Lencheski.
Mr. Chair, I think it's helpful to hear how you're thinking about that and to hear Assistant Commissioner Mossman. And I'd like to incorporate the Biskins Amendment to my amendment.
Is there any further discussion on that? Hearing none, all favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevail. Prevails. We now have the DE2 amendment.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Loon.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have a roll call vote on this.
A roll call has been requested. We will have a roll call on the DE2 amendment as amended. Any further discussion? Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to understand, since this subpart F has become a bigger part of the discussion, exactly what it does. The only phrase I've heard in English and not in tax speak is defer foreign income to banks. So if there's anybody who can just provide a little more clarity on what it is and why we should do it.
Mr. Michael, could you please clarify that and tell Representative Horton why we should do it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hortman, I'll try. Subpart F, refers to a subpart of the Internal Revenue Code that deals with how domestic corporations pay tax on their foreign source income. And the general rule under Subpart F is if it is Subpart F income, it's taxable to the corporation under the U.S. tax. There are some exceptions, and this has sort of been a long-standing exception That keeps getting extended along with all of the other provisions that the federal government, because of their budget rules, keeps extending on a 1 or a 2 year basis. That allows these large, typically money center banks that have foreign operations and that have some of this foreign source income to defer it until they actually do what's generally called repatriate it. And it's, it relates to interest financing income. I think an argument that you can make for doing this is, on paper, this indicates, the revenue estimates have always indicated that, not conforming raises $1 million or $1.5 million in additional revenue. I have had multiple calls from tax preparers, and understand that because this is a deferral provision, as with Representative Biskin's amendment, there's a provision that requires in the current year that you essentially add that back and pay tax on it, but then when you repatriate it, you subtract it in the later year. So there's an addition on one side and a corresponding subtraction on the other side for the later tax year. I've had multiple calls from tax preparers, and I've had conversations with auditors in the Department of Revenue, that everybody's frustrated with this provision because people don't get it right. I think there's the line people in the Department of Revenue think that it may not, in fact, actually generate additional revenue to the state, even though the revenue estimates suggest that's the case. Tax preparers have expressed frustration to me that they can't get their convince their clients, these are outside accountants, to do it right, and that oftentimes they find that they're taking too much in the way of the deduction side rather than in not doing the add back. And so there may be compliance, and there are definitely complexity issues with this and likely compliance issues, and there may be some question as to whether the nominal amount on the spreadsheet actually is really ending up in the state treasury. So that, to go along with trying to get the chairs asked me to make a case for that, I think that would be the best case for doing it. But it has a budget cost.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. We should do that more often.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hortman, you still have the floor?
Oh, I'm through. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Rukavina.
Chair, would Representative Hortman interpret for me what Mr. Michael just said?
Representative Hortman, what do we just...
I want to see this now.
What do we just do?
In English.
Yeah. It's okay. More trouble than it's worth.
Thank you. Okay, members, I have another amendment to the DE2 amendment. Apparently, we needed to go a little further, or maybe Representative Biskins could make it, or I'll make it. Mr. Michael.
On reflection, we've concluded that we need to make another modification to the Biskins amendment on page six, what we want to do is to delete the new language on lines 15 and 16, and on page 10, delete the new language on lines 31 and 32.
Representative Lancheski, would you consider that a friendly amendment?
Yes.
By Representative Biskins, would you make the amendment? Okay, Representative Biskins moves the amendment that Mr. Michael just described. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. To the DE2 amendment, I see that there is no further discussion. Oh, Representative Druskowski, I had you on those. I'm sorry.
I pass, Mr. Chair.
Okay. The DE2 amendment, the committee legislative assistant will take the roll. As amended.
Representative Davids.
Aye.
Representative Loon.
Aye.
Representative Lancheski.
Aye.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Bills.
Aye.
Representative Biskins.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Representative Crawford.
Aye.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Depke.
Aye.
Representative Druskowski.
Aye.
Representative Erickson.
Aye.
Representative Garofalo.
Yes.
Representative Gottwald. Representative Hortman.
Aye.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Aye.
Representative Knuth.
Aye.
Representative Koonin.
Aye.
Representative Lesh.
Aye.
Representative Loeffler.
Aye.
Representative Mack.
Aye.
Representative Marquardt.
Aye.
Representative Myra.
Aye.
Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to waste Representative Kipmeyer's time. No.
Waste my time.
Well, you called for a roll call vote on unanimity.
Whatever.
Oh, Loon. Okay, Representative
Loon.
Does
that change your vote?
No, same thing.
Okay, no.
We don't want to waste time here.
Representative Runback.
Aye.
Representative Tilbury.
Yes.
Representative Wardlow.
Aye.
I'm probably the only right vote.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Loon.
I know you hate the to that point, but may I respond?
After whatever. I've lost control today anyways. Representative Loon, to that point.
To that point, Mr. Chair. Just to Representative Rukavina, I appreciate your consideration. I just thought, you know, we may not have so many opportunities in this committee the rest of the year to have such a positive vote on all things, so I didn't want to miss the opportunity.
Would any member like to change their vote?
No, I'm fine.
There being 26 ayes and one nay, the motion prevails. Any other amendments? With that, I see that there are no other amendments, so I will move House File 451 as amended. With the DE2 amendments, but well, just as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. So we have House File 451 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Would you cancel the room for tonight, please?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Okay, with that being said, we will go to, we're very fortunate here today, two folks, I believe. I believe Mr. Mike Hickey was on the list to testify yesterday. We're giving folks between 2 and 3 minutes. We'll ask some questions. Then we have a presentation from an economist, and we reached out to Representative Lincheski if there's any economist you'd like to bring forward to the committee, we will certainly entertain that sometime next week or in the near future. So that being said, if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir, and present your comments.
All three parts, I think. Mr. Chairman, members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the largest small business group in the state and also the largest business group in terms of entities, with about 13,000 members statewide and 300,000 members across the nation. Mr. Chairman, I feel like I'm hitting the rewind button. I just got the chance to do this in the Senate, so I'll just hit the points really quick. It comes as no surprise to anybody who knows anything about NFIB, but we're strongly opposed to the tax part of the governor's budget. We feel it's unrealistic in these economic times or in any times, damaging to Minnesota's economy, damaging to Minnesota's investment in jobs climate, and I think that comes as no surprise. I was a little shocked when I attended the governor's press conference to actually hear about and comprehend the 13.95% rate. That is so out of the norm and so out there that we would have by 3 percentage points roughly the highest income tax rate in the nation via the surtax for 3 years. And I don't think you could do a more damaging thing to the Minnesota economy other than enact a tax policy that extreme and that drastic, and strongly urge you to reject that. At 10.95%, the permanent expansion on the top rate, we're going to have the second highest income tax rate in the nation. If we somehow hypothetically enacted the whole thing, which I know is not possible at this current legislature, we would have the number three and number one top rates in the nation. And just really the wrong message to send to the entrepreneurs and the job creators, many of them who file sub-S forms, pay their income taxes through the individual income tax, and not the message we want to send, and not the vision of Minnesota we hold. When you look at other provisions of the proposal, it's likely that capital gains would not get decoupled if somehow we hypothetically enacted this. So not only we'd have the top income tax rate, we'd have the top capital gains rate in the nation. And that is really the wrong signal to send to the investors, the angel investors, the entrepreneurs, and the people we're looking to try to lead us out of this recession and create jobs. When I compare this proposal to other things we've seen in this committee, over in the Senate committee, this goes so far beyond the other top rate proposals we've seen over the last several years. And the people who proposed those in the past would never go this far because they know this is not realistic and they know this is actually economically damaging. And so I think that needs to be noted, that this goes way beyond any other proposal we've seen in the past. And we weighed in on those and we weren't supportive of them. But this goes way beyond it. And finally, the one thought I want to leave you with, you look at what we're trying to do with our budget problem, but also what we're trying to do to rev up our economy. You know, who is creating the jobs and who do we think is going to help lead us out of this recession? It's the very people who are affected by these proposals, probably more so on the 10.95 rate, but also very successful entrepreneurs who'd feel the sting of that surtax. These are the people who are creating the jobs most likely, or are creating the jobs, expanding their businesses, not somebody taxed at rates below this, making very little money, laying people off, has a stagnant business, just trying to hang on. Those probably aren't the people who are going to help us. It's the very people who are affected by this proposal. So anyways, I appreciate the time to weigh in on this, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Any questions for Mr. Hickey with the NFIB? First of Loeffler, and then Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hickey, I was surprised by your characterization of the small businesses under this threshold as not being the ones who I think will pull us out, because I think actually a lot of them are hardworking businesses that are working hard to maintain their payroll, and that might be part of why they're not, you know, moving ahead, because they've got a real commitment to their employees and they've got a real commitment to their community. But do you have a sense of your membership or small businesses? I haven't seen this, of kind of how are small independent businesses array across, you know, the income categories? I assume, you know, the economy obviously has had an impact on everybody, I suspect. But do we have a sense of how many of our smallest businesses, you know, struggle to even just have a profit? You know, obviously in a startup year, you usually have a lot of investments, a lot of depreciation. But, you know, kind of an array of your members in terms of how many of them are, you know, are making it through this recession and how many are just kind of hanging on?
Mr. Hickey?
I'm Representative Loeffler. I haven't had a chance to survey lately. But you look at the break points or the bracket points on the 10.95 rate. I was also surprised, I forgot to mention the $85,000 threshold. Is that wealthy in anybody's mind in this day and age? That's how low for single people the new 10.95 rate goes. And we have a lot of members making an income in that range, 150 joint, which is not very hard for a working couple to reach in this day and age. So I can guarantee you, just from the knowledge of my members, a lot of them would be impacted by the new permanent top rate of 10.95%. It's not hard to hit those thresholds at all.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thought I don't think Mr. Hickey was able to be here the day that we talked about how this is taxable income, those thresholds, and that it would be typical. It was confirmed by Mr. Mossman that a single person at $85,000 might be more about $120,000 before credits and deductions, and that the dual income household might be closer to $200,000. So I just wanted to let you know that that's the taxable income after all those adjustments, and I'm assuming for business people it might be even that they have greater deductions because they have the depreciation and all their business investments and those sorts of things. So it's hard to know, just as you said you hadn't had a lot of research on that. We don't have a lot of research yet on exactly who that would fall on as well, but it's important that it's taxable.
Representative Lesh?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to respond briefly One more time if I could. No, I understand that, but those are still really low threshold, Representative Loeffler, compared to what we've seen in the past.
Representative Lesh?
Difference between taxable and net.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hickey, have you ever bought a car at a car lot?
Mr. Hickey, have you ever bought a car?
I have.
Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hickey, did you pay the sticker price on that car when you walked in to the car lot?
Mr. Hickey.
Representative Lesh, that's usually my policy. No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hickey, I didn't think so. But it strikes me as odd of how afraid some people are of the sticker price on Minnesota taxes when you don't pay that on your taxes. I mean, if there's a sliver of your income that you pay that top tier on, if you can't find a way to sidestep it, as a lot of people do, I just find it curious as to why that 10-point or that top tier rate gets highlighted as supposedly it's the boogeyman that's going to scare everyone away, when every reasonable small business person that I know knows that if you can't find a way to avoid that through deductions or credits, you're not paying that rate on your full income anyway. That's just my rhetorical point.
Comment? Okay, thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Hickey. We will now go to Mr. John Spry, professor, University of St. Thomas, to make a presentation. And I believe that there in your packet is the PowerPoint of the presentation. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
John Spry. I'm a professor at the University of St. Thomas, but my views are solely those of myself as a private citizen from St. Paul and do not represent any current or past employer.
Thank you very much for that.
And so the presentation we're working on with some technical problems is entitled The Economics of Taxation, Theory and Evidence for Budget Evaluation. And what I would like to do is present you with a quick run-through of some key facts from Economics 101 that are applicable for consideration of the governor's budget. And I thank Representative Lesh for setting me up so well, there is the sticker price the economists look at, which is called the effective marginal tax rate. If you increase your taxable income by $1, what share of that is paid in tax revenue? And one thing I wanted to point out is currently when you take our 7.85% rate, the 2.9% of both sides of the Medicare tax federally, and the current 35% federal rate, at the top income brackets, the current effective marginal tax rate, state and local combined, is about 43%. And because there are federal tax hikes in the president's budget for tax year 12, in current law they would occur in tax year 13, and these would take the federal personal rate to 39.6. In 2013, the recent health reform bill raises the Medicare tax on both sides, employer-employee, to 3.8%, and then we have the 13.95% proposal. When you add those together and take into account some fairly obscure provisions you should learn a lot about, the PEACE and PEP provisions, which are federal provisions that take away the personal exemption for high-income taxpayers and take away a significant fraction of the federal deductibility of state and local taxes, and these provisions in current law return in 13, and in the president's budget they would occur next tax year in 12. So the rate we're looking at, federal and state combined, is going from 43 to 55. When the fifth tier expires, then you would have that 3 percentage point reduction. That's, while it's a 27.9% increase in marginal effective tax rates for taxpayers in these circumstances, as we will see in a little bit, the economics suggests that the economic harm, the inefficiency, would not be linear but quadratic or proportional to a square, and would be about 63% higher. So if you think about at our current tax rates, just having a little increase in the marginal tax rate, there's not a good single number I can give you, but you might think that the cost of raising one more dollar by focusing on that targeted base at a little bit higher rate than our current 43% is between $1.50 and $4.80. So I've been watching this committee, and in the discussion there's been, in my opinion, too much focus on the number of people that might move and not enough focus on some of the very issues that Representative Lesh correctly raised. High marginal income tax rates can cause people to make bad economic decisions that are economically inefficient in several ways. First, there's a strong incentive to time taxable transactions to occur in lower tax years. So as you consider a fifth tier that is designed to end after 3 years, to the extent that a taxpayer can control the timing, they might want to time to take transactions before or after that ends. There's also a strong incentive to rearrange financial and accounting transactions to engage in the maximal legal tax avoidance. There's a disincentive to supply additional hours of effort. However, I must caution you that for male workers, the finding is small or very small in the economic literature. But the effect on how much you work or whether you are entering the labor force due to changes in taxes in the literature is modest but important, particularly for female workers, not for male workers. There's a disincentive to invest in education and on-the-job training, because if you do something that's a training program that increases your income that puts you into one of these brackets, you get a smaller share of the pre-tax benefit to society from your work. There's a disincentive to take risky or disagreeable jobs. You might prefer, for example, to have a salary job versus a sales commission job, because your income would be variable and that's less tax preferred under the governor's budget. There's a strong incentive to take compensation in tax preferred forms, perks, exotic business trips, tax-free benefits. And there's also something that hasn't been discussed in this committee to the best of my knowledge. There's a strong incentive, if you stay in Minnesota, to change your investment portfolio. For example, to invest in lower risk or tax-free investment, municipal bonds are state and federal tax-free. The federal government currently does not allow Minnesota to tax treasury bills. So you can imagine somebody that's in these rates could miss the tax entirely if they're, say, a widow that's elderly and investing in safe investments by taking their money out of a few equities or their local bank and putting it all in treasuries. So there are these many dimensions, and I wouldn't just talk about mobility, that taxpayers could respond to changes in tax rates. And this brings us to a really useful tool, and I have a book I'm going to temporarily loan to the committee, The Marginal Cost of Public Funds. This is a tool that gives us great insight. It is a measure of the total cost to the economy of collecting one more dollar in tax revenue. That's a very important concept I'd like you to think about more and discuss. Related to it is the concept of deadweight loss, or the excess burden of a dollar of tax revenue. And this is a measure of beyond the tax dollar that's collected that shows up on your budget documents. What's the dollar value of all those decisions that have been distorted, where somebody made an investment that's not the investment that gives the highest rate of return to society, but gives the investor the best after-tax rate of return? And in general, the marginal cost of public funds is going to be that sum of the dollar of revenue collected and the deadweight loss from those decisions made to collect the additional dollar of revenue. The Obama administration...
Excuse me, Dr. Sprite, would you mind withholding for 1 second? We have someone from IT to help so we can actually get your PowerPoint on the screen.
I can...
Thank you. It'll be just a minute.
Well, Madam Chair, I can just ask a question while he's getting the IT stuff. So.
By all means, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And just for that real rate of return, I just want to make sure I understand it. So right now there's that tax preference for U.S. Treasuries. You know, I'm a foolish investor, and I do things like buy stock in, well, I'm not going to say the stock that I bought. Never mind. And that stock has a 10% rate of return. However, if I were to put it into U.S. Treasuries, assuming under this plan, like in my tax rate, I'm at 705. The real rate of return is that if I have no tax, if I pay no tax liability on it, and my common stock returns 7%, those are parallel investments with the same rate of return.
Dr. Spray.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I would just caution you, when you're looking at equities or even bonds, there's risk and return. So in making those investment decisions, always consider risk and return. And that's one of the points I'm trying to make, is if you're going to get the same rate of return from a low-risk treasury bill, which is not really the best investment in Minnesota, it's more of an investment in the federal government. If you're going to make that investment and get the same return as a high-risk investment in equity in some business, maybe even in Minnesota, given the higher risk, why make the riskier decision? And this is a well-known distortion from taxes in the finance and economic literatures.
And Madam Chair,
Representative
Garofalo, the point I was making is that there's a double whammy here, because in addition to not getting the extra revenue, you actually lose the revenue that you were collecting before. So, for example, if someone transfers those investments, and demographically right now, we're looking at baby boomers moving out of their peak earning years into the retirement age, and any good investment analyst would tell you that you want to move into safer investments. So there's already sort of a demographic pressure to move out of equities. This would provide an additional tax incentive to do that, to actually accelerate this trend away from taxable investments versus non-taxable investments from the state perspective.
Dr. Spray.
Madam Chair, Representative Graflow, the general rule among economists is you would like people to make decisions for common sense business reasons, and this is where you get a deadweight loss, is it's trying to measure the dollar value of the harm to the rest of the economy because you're changing the relative rate of return or the relative price between different decisions. And so instead of making the best decision that's privately best for you, that may be best for society in the absence of tax concerns, I think what you're trying to point out is you may make a decision that is best for you on an after-tax basis, but imposes costs on society.
Right. And Madam Chair, and to the testifier, it's a tax preference. Right? There's tax preferences for different classes of investments, and just like we have certain products right now that are regulated as tobacco products but not taxed as tobacco products, and then we have tobacco products that are taxed as tobacco products, there's a preference that exists there, and consumer behavior can be modified by it. So I guess it's I didn't mean to drill down too deep into that point, but it's a point well taken that as a middle-class investor, if I take it into consideration, certainly those with a lot more money than me would do it, and especially at instead of a 7.05 rate, at a 13.95 rate, it would give consideration. People should at least consider that before they cast their lot on these proposals.
Dr. Spray.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, and one thing I want to highlight is as you're making these decisions, except for decisions that cross state boundaries, the appropriate marginal rate to look at is not just the Minnesota marginal income tax rate, but it's the combined effect, because in many ways you are sharing your tax base with the federal government. Like a couple on a date with two straws and a milkshake, you're both drinking from the same milkshake. You're imposing your taxes, and one of the things I just want to point out is under current law or next year in the president's budget, there's significant federal tax hikes on high-income individuals, and that kind of affects your ability to get tax revenue out of that common milkshake.
Any follow-up, Representative Garofalo?
No, I think
okay. All right. Did any other members have questions at this point while we wrestle with the computer? Representative Erickson.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm one of those seniors who takes the strong incentive to invest in lower risks. I buy a lot of municipal bonds, so they're tax-free. So
you.
I'll be following this.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. All right, Representative Bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also, along with that, and maybe to these real numbers, do you also then, Professor Spry, Dr. Spry or Professor? I'm sorry, Dr. Spry.
That's fine.
Okay. Do you also then price in the inflationary risk that you run, as Representative Garofalo pointed out, with these different investment vehicles, and Representative Erickson moving towards fixed income investments? If there's an inflationary pressure, do you take that? Do you want to measure that real interest rate then that you're earning to equal a nominal interest rate subtracted, and then subtract out the the real interest rate and figure out where your money is best spent, and can that be affected regionally as well, because there's different price pressures to housing and other commodities around the country.
Dr. Spry.
Madam Chair, Representative Bills, my understanding is the current tax code does not have indexing of the taxation of interest, dividends, and capital gains for inflation. So we've been in a relatively low inflationary environment. Any increase of inflation, for example, to the levels of the 1970s, which some of us can remember, creates a larger tax on the inflationary increase in assets, because our tax code in general taxes the nominal return, not the real after-inflation return.
Representative Bills?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. All right, well, it looks like we are up and rolling, so if you'd like to resume.
Okay. So the marginal cost of public funds is a well-known concept, and to help explain this, I found a very useful circular from the Federal Office of Management and Budget that says, because taxes generally distort relative prices, they impose a burden in excess of the revenues they raise. Recent studies of the U.S. tax system suggest a range of values for the marginal excess burden, of which a reasonable estimate is 25 cents per dollar. So what this means in common language is, in making certain decisions at the federal government, the Office of Management and Budget has had the same policy under Presidents Obama, Bush, and Clinton, that $1 of federal spending costs the private sector economy a reasonable estimate of that dollar plus 25 cents of excess burden or deadweight loss. In general, that estimate of the marginal cost of public funds varies in several dimensions. First, if a tax is imposed on a more responsive or mobile tax base, the marginal cost of public funds will be higher. If the tax rate is larger, so I want to point out, if you had low tax rates, if, for example, the federal income tax rate was 10% and Minnesota had a 4% income tax, the distortions we're talking about in magnitude would be relatively small. I almost would say teeny, but relatively small at low tax rates for distortions. And another factor is if you're imposing a tax on a market that already has distortions and inefficiencies, that can affect the marginal cost of public funds. And so as we move forward to look at the administration's budget, the decision to focus additional revenue on a very narrow tax base at high tax rates that's a relatively mobile or responsive base will tend to make the marginal cost of public funds from income tax hikes particularly large. And so now I'm very happy to have the graphics, because this is one of the most important slides. This is a concept that is basically undisputed among economists, that the deadweight loss, the dollar value of the bad decisions made because of taxes, is proportional to the square of the tax rate. And so if you look on the left, we have a situation where there's a relatively low tax, which is measured as the difference between the price the buyer pays and the price the seller receives. And there's relatively a lot of tax revenue compared to the little red triangle of deadweight loss, because there's some fairly modest, small reduction in the quantity of economic activity. As we move to the middle slide and look at a medium tax, we see that as the tax rate, the marginal rate affecting participants in this market goes higher, the tax revenue rectangle becomes taller and not as wide, because there's a little bit more reduction in economic activity. And finally, on the slide on the right, we have a very high tax rate where there's a large reduction in economic activity, from the intersection of the supply and demand curves, which would be what we would think would happen without a tax, to the new quantity, Q2. And the reason mathematically this works can be seen on the graph. Higher tax rates both reduce the amount of economic activity that's taxable, and as the rate goes up, the average value of the lost economic activity goes up. So when you put those two things together, it's like multiplying them in geometry class. So at really low tax rates, the excess burden, like on the left, will be relatively small. And at relatively high tax rates, mathematically, the deadweight loss or excess burden will be large, which will make the marginal cost of public funds large.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bills.
Thank you.
No one's as excited about this as you are, so please ask a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Spry, in your on this slide on your tax wedging, are you tax wedging an excise tax or an income tax? Or just any tax in general?
I was doing a very generic tax, and I want to move more specifically on the next couple slides to look at an income tax and the governor's budget proposal.
Okay.
But I was trying to be as generic, because this principle that the distortions from a tax are proportional to the tax rate multiplied by itself is relatively general across tax types.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So your y-axis doesn't represent necessarily, like, if this was an excise tax on tobacco products, it doesn't represent the price of tobacco, it, or a labor market where the y-axis represents a wage rate. This is just a generic price.
It could represent several things, and I didn't say it was particularly any one product or market.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And do you have more specific data, if not today, but if we wanted to look at it, do you have specific data to how... as to how a tax would affect in the excise realm versus how a tax affects in the income realm in those markets?
Dr. Spry.
I prepared to try to look at the rates in the executive budgets, and I don't have anything prepared on excise taxes. And for brevity, I'll try to discuss that offline.
And that's okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To represent Bill's point, I'd be interested in that as well. I think the elasticity of an income tax solution versus, say, a sales tax, as Senator Ortman is looking at right now, would be interesting indeed to compare what the deadweight loss is and on whom. And I think without an elasticity frame around the income tax, I think Representative Bills and I would both be very interested when we pick out pieces. I think we get different results, so I'd be interested in that information as well.
Madam Chair, to this point.
Representative Bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then, Dr. Spry, if, could you go back a slide? Thank you. And then will you be speaking at all to the uncollected revenue loss that exists in the market due to this as well?
Dr. Spry.
Madam Chair, Representative Bills, right, it's one of the things when you look at the marginal cost of public funds, the very definition is you're looking at per dollar of tax revenue in the tax revenue rectangle, what is the total cost to the market participants in the market being taxed, which includes not just the revenue collected, but also that deadweight loss strike.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. All right, Dr. Spry, we got about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, obviously it's a very interesting proposal. So members, I would say, you know, if you've got a burning question you need to ask, ask it. Otherwise, we'll try to get through the meat of your presentation here.
So the relevant elasticity is what is called the elasticity of taxable income. How responsive is taxable income for the taxpayers affected by the changes in tax rates? And there's a large literature. I've provided a lot of documents to the committee administrator that will be available to you. My reading of the literature is there's tremendous uncertainty about this elasticity. However, the general findings are that the elasticity of taxable income is highest for high-income taxpayers, precisely because they have relatively more ways to respond, such as consulting a really good tax lawyer and accountant, than lower income individuals. So here's a very important slide of my calculations using a standard formula for the marginal cost of raising a dollar at different combined federal and state tax rates. And I want to first highlight that while the center column has what I think are my preferred estimates, there is so much uncertainty about the relevant elasticity, I wanted to show you some sensitivity analysis of how would the results look with a lower or higher elasticity. But focusing for brevity on the middle column, if the federal government didn't go ahead with the current law tax hikes, and we were at a 43% rate, raising another dollar from maybe raising the rate from 7.85 to 8% would probably cost somewhere around $2.30. Again, as you look across at that 43% rate, you can see there's tremendous uncertainty in exactly how leaky the revenue bucket is. And at a really relatively low elasticity of taxable income, it might only cost you $1.51 to get that higher revenue. At a really relatively higher elasticity of 0.7, that could get up to 4.81. But as you go down the columns and look at, for example, if you hit the 55% rate and you think about the wisdom of that fifth bracket, there the marginal cost of public funds really goes up because, as we saw earlier, that deadweight loss varies with the square of the tax rate. And you're now in the situation where the taxpayer has more to gain by sheltering a dollar from income than by earning another dollar. Because at a 55% tax rate, if you can shelter a dollar, you gain 55 cents. If you work a little bit more and earn a dollar, you keep 45 cents. So I have some slides I'm going to skip showing the tremendous variation in elasticities of taxable income. The other point,
Dr. Sprive, just suspend for a moment. We have a question. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Dr. Sprive. I'm just curious, you know, you're talking about income taxes and maybe we've talked about sales taxes, but could you give me any examples where the taxation actually may improve efficiency in the market?
Dr. Sprive.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Knuth, if there's an externality in the market that's not being addressed because of high transaction costs between the parties, such as pollution, one can imagine, and there's a literature on, for example, sulfur dioxide markets in Southern California, where the marginal cost of public funds could be less than a dollar. Another example, at least I want to speak somewhat hypothetically, is if you have a tax expenditure that really promotes a really strange and unintended consequence, then closing that tax expenditure could have a marginal cost of public funds around or below or above a dollar.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just was curious, and I appreciate the sulfur dioxide and thinking again about the externalities of greenhouse gas emissions, and just curious, as I learn more in the tax committee, I hear more and more positives about putting a price on greenhouse gas emissions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, please proceed.
So I'm going to try to hit a couple things quickly due to time. First, generally Minnesota, you should think of as a small open economy. We are about 0.08% of the world's population, but about 0.3% of the world's economy. There's going to be a lot of discussion of mobility. My review of the literature suggests that the amount of mobility of people fleeing is relatively modest, because you only have to have people change their location enough to have gross wages adjust. And I will also leave you Joe Stieglitz's textbook, which has some excellent discussions of this topic, and I just don't have time to get to that. There's also information about increasing prosperity and income inequality that Representative Dabney may have wanted some more information about. And I want to get to the final two slides. One of the readings of the budget documents without seeing the tax bill itself, which I believe nobody has seen, is that the administration is proposing a fourth and a first tier of 10.95% in the long run. And this is due to their decision to not index the fourth tier for inflation. Going back to President Reagan and Governor Qui, it's been federal and state tax policy to index the personal income tax code for inflation. If you pass the governor's budget, sometime 15 to 30 years from now, between 30 and 70% of taxpayers, depending on what happens to wage growth and inflation, are going to be in the 10.95% bracket. Because if you index some brackets, but you don't index one bracket, everybody eventually in the long run ends up in that bracket. And another thing I want to point out that you may want to consider is you should consider asking for revenue to come up with a dollar value of the increase in the personal income tax expenditures that would occur under the governor's budget. And we have an era of scarcity, and there are always trade-offs and tough decisions to make, and you might want more information about why the governor is, in my opinion, proposing to expand the size and dollar value of high-income taxpayers' tax expenditures. So I want to leave you with this quote that you can read on the screens from Abraham Lincoln. There are few things wholly evil or wholly good. Almost everything, especially of government policy, is an inseparable compound of the two, so that our best judgment of the preponderance between them is continually demanded. And so I would ask you, as you consider the governor's budget and proposals from the previous legislative session that this committee has heard that haven't been enacted that are good ideas, that you consider the trade-off between the marginal cost of raising public funds, but also a related concept, the marginal value of public expenditures. And without looking at the marginal value of public expenditures or the marginal cost of public funds, you don't have as much information and vocabulary and tools to make the best budget decisions.
Thank you, Dr. Sprite. Representative Hortman, you have a question?
Thank you. I was just wondering if you had some reflections on the sales tax base in Minnesota and how narrow it is and the economic utility of that. The example I always give my constituents is if they're a tool manufacturer and I'm a lawyer, they're taxed on their product and I'm not taxed on my product. And I'm wondering if that's why manufacturers have left and service providers are still here.
Dr. Sprite.
Madam Chair, Representative Hortman, if my memory serves me correctly, there have been some bills that I like a lot by you and Representative Lencheski in the past addressing the issue of sales tax base. Economists generally think of the sales tax as a tax on final purchases of consumer purchases, and often you'll hear an economist like Art Roenick say something along the lines of, all final purchases of goods and services by consumers should be taxed once, but only once, not multiple times through tax pyramiding. And in fact, if you want another reference, the 2010 Nobel Prize award statement in economic science said, in fact, that the optimal tax rate on intermediate business purchases is zero, and that's why Professor Diamond in part was awarded his Nobel Prize. So the general economist's view of good tax policy is to not tax multiple times with pyramiding, but to tax once at a low rate on a broad base of all final purchases.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you. You are the first person who has ever told me you liked that tax bill, so thank you.
Well, on that happy note, we have reached the hour of 12 o'clock. So I thank the testifier. As he mentioned, our committee administrator does have numerous materials that he shared, so The committee will have an ample opportunity to review more of his materials in detail. So with that, we are finished with our business today. Good government all the time. And we are adjourned.